This is the order of battle!
Thanks for joining the Order of Battle podcast for another episode. Joel, Jason, and Sometimes A discuss collecting G.I. Joe, other 1/18 scale action figures, and in general, what sparks joy. It's a lot of things, but almost always toys. This is the Order of Battle podcast.
I had the honor of sitting down with Tim Dunnigan, who in 1987 played Captain Power in Captain Power and the Soldiers of the Future. If you haven't gone back and watched that recently, you should. He was also Davy Crockett in The Magical World of Disney. His resume extends beyond these two things, but we talk a lot about that, and that's the two things that a lot of us are going to resonate the most with, being kids in 1987 and 1988. Tim is going to be in Augusta, Georgia at Joe Fest and in Louisville, Kentucky at Kentuckiana. I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did, and I hope you come out and see him at one of these two shows this summer. Meet the man, get a signature, buy a couple memorabilia, and welcome him into the community. Again, it was my privilege to have this conversation, and I thank Tim for being here, and I hope you guys enjoy it.
Todd was saying that you guys met through Steve, and that you'd be joining us in Augusta, and that you're in Missouri?
No, I'm in California. I'm in Los Angeles. I grew up in Missouri.
He mentioned St. Louis, and I was like, well, that's a...
I believe there's another convention in July called Kentuckiana or something like that.
That's in Louisville, Kentucky.
I had planned a trip to St. Louis to see my family. So I said, well, I'll go. And then instead of flying me there, you can just rent me a car and it's only like 3 or 4 hours. So I'll just drive there. And
perfect. So you'll be hanging out with us a couple of times this summer.
Yeah. Looking forward to it. Really have enjoyed talking to Todd and Steve a lot. You know, for me, Jason, this is all kind of, you know, I had no idea anybody was interested in that show at all. I mean, I still get emails from some real hardcore fans, you know, but, and, you know, and I'm talking about from Europe and Asia and everywhere. So, but I didn't realize that until there was there's an Facebook play spot, whatever. And on there, I kind of said hi one day and man, people went crazy. And so then Steve said, you know, you ought to try to do some. Why don't you do any of these shows? And I was like, well, nobody's ever asked me. So that's pretty much the bottom line, you know.
That show was, what, 35, 40 years ago now? So,
oh, yeah, 1987, yeah.
Everybody that was a fan of that show, you wouldn't have heard from all through their teens and their 20s. And now that we have, some of us have grandchildren, not me, but children and jobs and money to spend to buy the toys, the comics, the DVDs, that's how we all get back into this. And then, you know, of course, we have to rope you back in. You were the guy.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, I was lucky in my career. I got to do a lot of really cool stuff and playing Captain Power, you know, and still being the only Captain Power there was. I got to play Davy Crockett, too, which was pretty exciting. But there's been some other Davy Crocketts. And I was also one of the original guys on the A-team, but that's a whole other story.
That's why we thought it would be fun. Both Augusta, Joe Fest, and Kentuckiana are predominantly G.I. Joe focused shows.
Right.
But nostalgia is nostalgia. We're all there. So yeah, they're predominantly a G.I. Joe show, but there's so much crossover. Even though it's predominantly a G.I. Joe show, people are into Motu or He-Man. They're into G.I. Joe Transformers. They're into Mask and Captain Power.
Right. Todd was telling me that because, and this was something I found really interesting, that because the G.I. Joe and the Captain Power figures were the same size, that might draw people because they draw, that's what the size that they collected. You know, these are all things this is all new to me and very interesting, actually.
You were on the other side of this.
We never had anything to do with it, really. You know, I asked Mattel for some toys. They told me no. So it was, okay, well, fine, you know, great.
Wow. Okay. You're only the face and voice and body of it.
Yeah, well, I was only the name of the show, yeah. And I said, hey, could, you know, because they gave us, I don't want to make, you know, this terrible, but they did give us like a, you know, a striker jet or whatever it was and everything. And they gave me a couple of things. But I said, hey, could I get a couple? And they said, well, you know, yeah, but we're going to charge you for them. And I said, no, I'm not paying for those. Are you out of your mind? I just flew down to, you know, I have one day off, you know, or two at the most. And I'd fly down to and do a toy show and do, you know, everything for nothing. And they wouldn't even give me a couple of jets. So that kind of set the tone right there with Mattel and us. We didn't, cast members and I, when we're down in Augusta over a beer, I'll tell you some great stories about dealing with those guys. So
you answered one of my questions. I am of an age where so many of my peers have become sober for whatever life reason. So I always tell people, like, I want to clink cups, but if it has to be water or coffee, it doesn't have to be a drink. So you said beers. I'm perfect there.
let me tell you something. I drink very, I mean, when I was younger, hey man, I used to throw them back pretty good, but I'm almost 70 years old now, so I don't drink hardly at all, but I love social sitting around and talking and having, you know, I'm from St. Louis, so I tend to yap a little.
Well, we have some good St. Louis crew that'll be around as well. This is an audio-only podcast, so I do a full and complete edit.
Of course. I mean, editing is our friend, believe me, I know very well. So.
I sound like a champ edited, not so much unedited.
Most of us aren't, Jason, so don't worry about it. Believe me, it's, you know, I grew up in the theater. I started as a stage actor in New York. Well, I started in St. Louis, but then in New York, and then CBS signed me to come out to California and do TV. And I had no idea about film or camera or anything. So they said, well, you can do it. I was like, I could do it again. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, hell, this is a lot easier. You know? Yes, I understand.
Doing it again stops at dress rehearsal when you're on theater.
Oh, you're doing it again in theater. It's called, buddy, you better just keep going. Figure something out because that's not stopping, you know. Actually, one time I did a show in college. It was called The Night of the Burning Pestles, a restoration. It's a horrible show. And I had this little part, and I had just done a big part with St. Louis Rep Company. And I was really wanting to end my year on that because I was the first student who ever got like a lead role. And I was all excited. And they said, hey, we need you to come in this student show. I was very good at sword and, of course, work and stuff like that. So I knew how to do all that. Didn't need you to do the horse step fight. And I was like, I don't want to do that. Oh, no, you got to do it. So opening night, my whole kneecap just went to the back of my leg. And that show, we actually did have to stop and get an ambulance and take me to the hospital.
Oh, shit.
Oh, yeah. I've had all kinds of fun stuff. With people coming up on stage, you know, I'm in the middle of a drama and some people just walk up. You never know. You know, that's what made it fun, though. That was always a good time.
Did this start in primary and in middle and high school and just move into college? Or what got you into theater?
High school. I went to a school in St. Louis in Kirkwood, Missouri, a suburb called St. John Vianney. It was a Catholic boys high school. And I had no ambitions. I had no desire to act or anything to do with theater or film or anything. I wanted to play baseball. I wanted to be a baseball player. That was my focus. But all my friends were kind of involved in the student council there. And they said, hey, you know, our school hasn't done a school play in a few years and we should do a school play. So they said, oh, let's do this. You know, we're going to do this little show. You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. You know, it's a little musical. He was on Broadway. You know, and they said, well, we need technical help. I said, oh, I'll do the lighting. So I really enjoyed it. And then that really got me into it because from that moment, I wanted to be a lighting designer. I really enjoyed doing the lighting. And so as things go, this show was pretty successful. And they asked us to tour it around the city at other high schools. And so, you know, the old story, one of the guys got it. And they said, you know, because I would sit there and I knew all the whole show by heart because I would do the light cues. They said, well, you have to do it. And I was like, you're out of your mind. You know, and they said, no, you're going to do it. Well, you know, Jason, I got up there and I rehearsed. You know, I had like, I think 5 days to learn the show and do it. And, you know, and there was dancing and all, you know, I'm no dancer or anything. Anyway, I got out there and I just felt so good. I enjoyed it so much. And then I had people come in. It was kind of the first time in my life I had people come and say, wow, you were really good, you know? And I'd never had anybody tell me that before. Usually they were saying, like, you are a lousy ball player, you know? So they said, yeah, you know, man, you're really good at this. So I got more involved. And the next year I got the lead in the show in high school. And then I went to a college and I got to do shows there. I trained. My training was at Six Flags Over Mid-America. I got a summer job for 3 summers doing 7 shows a day, 6 days a week. And let me tell you,
wow,
that'll teach you a whole lot right there. You know,
sure.
Great. They don't do it anymore. I can't believe it. I just found out they don't even do those shows anymore. But that was a great job. I think we made almost $210 an hour, something like that, you know. But you got to be in front of an audience over and over and over. And it just taught you. So then I got into college. And community college, I didn't really know what I was going to do. And we did a show that got won the regionals at the National Theater Festival. So we took that show to Kansas University. And while I was there, Kansas offered me, like, you want to come and go to school here? And then this Webster College was right where I grew up. And it was a really good fine arts school. The guy there said, don't go there. Come with us. But first I went and I came to California. I was 20. And I was a band, and I worked at the Troubadour and Knott's Berry Farm, and we were on the Mike Douglas Show. You probably don't remember that; you're not old enough. But I kind of got that job, and then while I was doing that, somebody got tickets to go to a taping of the Jeffersons. I don't know if you remember that show.
Absolutely.
Well, I remember going in. I was really excited. I said, TV, wow, you know, I'd never been, and I sat in that audience and I watched it, and I thought, this is crap. This is terrible. I've done better shows than this. You know, I can do, you know, and all of a sudden I thought, wait a minute, I can do it. So I quit the band and I called the guy from Webster up and said, hey, you still got can you still get me in the program, you know, the conservatory program? You have to be accepted. He said, yeah. So I went back and that was it. So I got to do some really big shows there as far as your resume, really good things on your resume. I went to New York and, I got the first audition I went on was a play, and I went into these big time agents and they said, can you do a monologue? I said, sure, I'm trained. You know, I was a theater trained guy. So I did a classical train. I did a Shakespeare and I did a regular one. And they said, okay, we're going to sign you. 3 days later, they sent me over to CBS. They said, well, you're not right for this part, but we want to sign you to a development deal. 2 weeks later, I was on a plane to California.
Wow.
And that was 40 years ago, you know, so. I got here, and when I got to California, I was like, oh, yeah, because I remembered I was here in 75 and living in New York. New York's a great town, don't get me wrong, but I did not like living in New York. It was not for me. It was just too, I liked the California scene. You know, it was, you know, the weather was nice. Why not? You know, I was loving it. And I started working. I got this reoccurring role in a show called Wizards and Warriors, which was kind of a little bit ahead of its time, too. Jeff Conway, Walter Olkowitz, Duncan Regaer, Julia Duffy, who was in it. And it was kind of a comedic Dungeons and Dragons. And I played this kind of evil prince's brother who was a kind of a buffoon, you know. And while I was doing that, I came in on the A-team and they hired me for that. So I was doing 2 series at the same time. I was too stupid to understand how lucky I was to be doing that. And then we filmed the A-team and I came back and they said, we're replacing you. And I was devastated. I was absolutely devastated. I'd never been fired from any job in my entire life. A dishwasher, nothing, you know, a badge of honor in our family, going and do your job, you know, don't complain. You know, Stephen Cannell told me to come to his office and I did. And he said, you know, Tim, you didn't do anything wrong. It's our fault. You're just too tall. You make T look, I was 6'5 at that time. And, you know, you make T look short. And, you know, he showed me a scene. He played a scene where I picked T up and carried him up into a plane. He said, look, you just picked him up like he was a rag doll. You know, and I was like, well, that's what I was supposed to do, you know. And they said, no, you look too young. You know, I did film a lot younger than I was. So they said, we're replacing you. And I mean, I was really depressed. I was really upset about it. But, you know, you just kind of buck up and you realize, well, you know, just move on. And I always was working. I always got a guest star. And then there was a series for NBC I did called Mr. Smith. That was Ed Weinberger and Stan Daniels. They did Taxi and Mary Tyler Moore. So it was a comedy. And But again, I worked with orangutans. I had to work with these. I had to go in early to actually train with these apes because they, you know, these guys, they could kill you in like 2 seconds.
Oh, yeah.
But so I had to get them where they accepted me, you know, and all that. And that was a fascinating time. And, you know, like I said, then I just kept doing, you know, Fall Guy. Lee Majors was a great guy. And he hired me for 2 Fall Guys.
And at 6'5", you're going to be great on Fall Guy.
Oh, yeah, because Doug was a tall guy. Doug Barr was a real tall guy. And plus, I'll tell you what got me the second episode was the first shot that I did on the first show was I had to get into maybe about 2.5 feet of water. And they said, we want you to wrestle this alligator, a real one. I said, okay, you know. And the guy said, oh, no. He said, don't worry about it. He said, because we're going to put a wire around his mouth. He says, you know, their jaw muscles are really weak to open, but, you know, it's if they get open, that's when you're in trouble. But don't worry. And I'm like, yeah, well, it's easy for you to say, don't worry, you know. But anyway, you know, I worked with every animal in Hollywood. So I got in the water and I rolled around this thing, you know, and Majors was there. As I rolled up one time, I saw the wire come off. I saw it come off its mouth and I just tossed it and I got out of there and Majors was waiting there with a blanket. He said, I don't know who the hell you are, but you're okay with me. And from that moment on, he said, come on, I want you to come back and do another episode. And Lee was a really nice guy, really treated me so kindly. It was a very fun time to be with. Cheers, I got to do Mersh Throats and all that. And then Arm the Soldiers of the Future, I said, what the hell would name a show that? That's ridiculous, you know. But I read the script and I thought, hey, you know, this is pretty good. You know, for sci-fi, this was, you know, and I knew nothing about, you know, sci-fi. And it was written so well. And so I went down and did Hollywood Boulevard. I remember, you know, that I went in and I remember I walked in and they had drawings up on the wall of all the, and I thought, my God, what is this thing? And I went in and I recorded the audition and I felt really good about it. I was really excited. I thought I did a good job. And I went back to my house and my agent called and said, you got to go back. The tape didn't work. It didn't record. And I thought, oh man, I'll never do another audition like I did that time, you know, but luckily I got it. That was it. I went up to about 3 weeks later, I was on a plane to Toronto and I lived up there for 5-6 months. And then when that was over, then Davy Crockett came up. That was a long process too, for months. They put me on a retainer because they auditioned, I don't know, 3,000, 4,000 guys for that part. And I got it, you know, and it was really exciting to work, you know, in something, an iconic thing like, you know, Fess Parker. And I remember all that and watched it when I was a kid. So it was really exciting. It was a tough shoot. We shot that out in the middle of nowhere up in Vancouver, outside of Vancouver, about 2 hours outside. And we would get in helicopters to have to go to locations. And, you know, it was a lot of fun. And I got to be in the lead float on the Macy's Day Parade and, you know, stuff like that. So, you know, when I look back on my career, those are the things you remember. You remember the how much fun it was and also all the great people that you got to meet and work with, George Bard and Lee Majors and so many more. You know, just I was very, very lucky and privileged and that's it. You know, after a while, I decided I wanted to try to do something different. And I kind of said, I'm going to take a step back here and I want to try to do some business. And so I went into the mortgage business and I did that for 25 years till last year. And most of my clients were in the film and TV business. I did a lot of famous actors and directors that did their mortgages for their houses. And it was just another way of kind of, you know, you working things out and just like a script, you know, working out a character, working out a loan is kind of it's just more numbers and things. But I had a great teacher, a friend of mine named Tim Brahim, who was a wonderful teacher and one of the best loan guys in the country. So I was lucky there, too. I had a lot of luck involved. Trust me. I mean, not that I don't think that I worked hard or anything like that, but you know, luck plays a big part in a lot of things.
I remember the Davy Crockett. That time of Disney was very cool. And with Captain Power, I mean, I was all in with everything coming out at that time. You know, and I didn't think about it as a child, right? Captain Power as a child is just fun, right? Just exciting laser guns and, you know, one of your teammates could change shape and there was robots and it was cool. And I was probably too young to understand the dystopic side of it. It just looked neat.
Correct. And broke so much ground as far as technology, you know, and that's, I think, why it's still popular. I think I'd like to think it was us, all of us great actors, but I, as far as the what I've learned over the years talking to fans, and it is that technology that was, you know, way ahead of its time, you know, breaking all kinds of ground.
When you look at it from today's lens, the first thing I'm seeing is that this should have been like Lawnmower Man or after, you know, so it's 5, 6, 7 years ahead of its time in terms of the graphics, which is incredible. I don't know who was on the team, but for a kid's show, it's stunning.
Yeah. I mean, it was all those guys have gone, they went on to, you know, do all the big stuff now, you know, they're all the big time guys. But you know, the fun part, Jason, was we shot that show in Toronto in a big old kind of factory. It was really what it was a bus, I think a bus garage or something. But it was, and everything was under one roof. The production team was there. The film and sets, construction was there. Miniature work was all done there. So we could see how that was being done, you know, and watch it. And, you know, right across from where we were filming, they were filming, you know, like in Star Wars where they go into the trenches. And we did all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, you go into the post op and they would, you know, you see how the characters were just, you know, and it, we were doing 1 to 2 minutes, I think, a week, which was unbelievable, you know. So it was so exciting because you felt like you were, you know, not just pushing the envelope as an actor, which is, you know, what we all strive for. It's that high you get from being an actor, to just realize we were pushing the envelope on all kinds of film and the art itself, you know, and the technology of it. And to be a part of that, I really appreciate it and how lucky I get and how privileged we all were to experience that and have so much fun. We had a blast, you know. It was a great time.
That's what I feel when I'm going back and watching it as a grown man, you know. It feels outside of time. If you were to have me, you know, gun to head, I would never say 87.
Well, I hear you. And the funny part for me is I haven't watched those shows in, I'll bet you, 30 years.
Well, you were there.
I just haven't. Well, when they came out with the DVD collection, I went and I signed some stuff for them, you know, some guy. And that's when they were maybe doing a reboot. So they were, you know, I was kind of involved in that a little bit. And, you know, I decided, well, if I'm going to go do this, I better, you know, I should probably watch these things because, you know, as an actor, it's, you know, and I learned a great lesson a long time ago about fans and things like this. And that was, I was doing a show in Atlanta, actually, and this was like 87 or 88, it was somewhere in there, you know, right where, and it was a big, you know, the Star Trek guys were all there, it was a big deal. And I had never been to any kind of convention or any Comic-Con or anything. So I was just kind of standing there going, holy crap, you know, this is amazing. And a guy came up to me and he was in a Captain Power outfit. And I was like, wow, you know, and he had a book. And he opened and he had every like TV guide or Us magazine, anything I had done, he had it in there.
Wow.
Now, my first reaction was, whoa, you know, what's the deal here, buddy? You know, this is kind of weird, you know, but he, you know, he was just so excited about it. And I had never dealt with anything like that beyond any other, you know, role. I mean, I had people come say, nice job, but, you know, that's it. And he had all this stuff. So they asked me to do a panel. And he stood, and I was, you know, asking, and I felt terrible because people would stand up and say, in War Dogs, and I'd be like, okay, I don't know which one that is. I'm sorry. Like, they all kind of blend. You have to understand, we were just flying, you know. You don't know. I don't know which one it was, you know. So anyway, he stood up and said, what was the power source for your communicators? And I remember I just looked at him and I said, AAA batteries, man. I don't know, you know. And I remember, you know, Jason, you know what I remember about that? The look on his face and how I heard him, you know, by my response. I was trying to be glib and cool and be funny. I realized I owed that guy a hell of a lot better answer than that. So I found him afterwards and I said, give me your address and I'm going to call the guys and from the show. And I'm going to get that answer for you, what's supposed to be. Because I felt so terrible that about that look on his face, that, you know, I don't know, maybe you know it when your son, you can just see that disappointment. I don't have a son, but that's how it was for me. I just thought, you know what? You're an ass. You're just a big ass. And be kinder and respect that guy a little bit better than you are. And that was a valuable lesson to me. And it also helped me to enjoy it all so much more.
You know, I think part of that comes from being on the forefront of that level of fandom. Conventions today are big business. And
yes.
And everybody's a little more savvy on both sides of the line. You're not likely to sit down with somebody like me and get those kind of questions today. You know, and for a long time, that was sort of the stereotypical joke, nerd question kind of thing.
Exactly. That's exactly what it was.
Back then, everyone's kind of learning at the same time. And so for someone to have cosplayed as Captain Power before cosplay was a word.
That's correct. That's exactly right. He was way ahead of his time, that guy.
He's way ahead of his time.
He was cool. That guy was cool. That guy was super cool.
But moreover, that question today, you would be able to answer because there's media training and there's marketing that would prep, you know, Robert Downey Jr. or whomever who's going to go on their press circuits. You would have had that training. But back then, who the hell knew?
Nobody.
And so I think it's incredible that somebody was that far ahead of the time as a fan, that they showed up in costume, that they built it, and that maybe they should have been more self-aware.
And it was, let me tell you, it was good. It looked really good. I mean, I was so impressed. I can't tell you. It was really cool.
Maybe he should have been more self-aware to know, like, that's a writer question, not an actor question. But even in all genres, you know, we don't necessarily know. So I think it's neat that you came across that when it was still brand new and it was still fresh and you could be caught off guard.
Oh, yeah. So caught off guard. I couldn't, you know, I just couldn't believe that anybody knew the show, number one, because we were syndicated and, you know, I don't know who was in charge of that. But, you know, there were some places where we were on at 2 o'clock in the morning or 5 a.m., you know, and then, you know, they said, well, the Mattel said the toys didn't sell that well. Well, they were basing all that on He-Man. He-Man was huge.
Yeah, that's not a fair determination.
That's exactly right. But if you look at the numbers of the sales, they were actually quite good. They actually sold pretty well. Mattel was a very difficult people to work with, mm-hmm. as far as when you're an artist and you're used to making film and, you know, it was bottom line business, corporate crap. And, you know, nobody, I mean, they came in and said, we want to put, you know, your images on lunch boxes. And we were all like, absolutely. Sounds fantastic. Well, they came in and said, we'll pay you $2,500 Canadian money at that time, which was 30% less. So that was the offer for them to use our likenesses, right? And I knew enough then, even back in 87, that was bull. That was a low ball, serious low ball. So we said, tell you what, no, we're thinking more about 50, maybe 50 grand a piece. You know, that's what we're looking at. And they said, no. So we hired a lawyer. The cast, we had to hire our own lawyer. And to represent us against them. And finally, they just said, no, we won't do it. And then they hired doubles to put on the costumes right in front of us, right at the place we were filming, and take the pictures and stuff.
Jeez.
Yeah, they were a real piece of work, Mattel.
You know, you hear about stuff like that, but I didn't realize that it was that vicious.
Yeah, you know, it was. It's, hey, man, it's, you know, I've learned after I became a mortgage broker. Business is business, baby. Don't take it personally. You know, it's just how it is. That's what the numbers say, and that's what it's going to be. So as I've gone older, I don't really care anymore. But I remember at the time, I was deeply hurt because we were, you have to understand, it was a really tough shoot. Those suits were unforgiving.
Speaking of cosplaying before cosplay was a word, you guys are doing costuming before 3D printing and microfibers and everything else. So, I mean, hell, that's probably all polyester and nylon. And
we would wear a cotton unitard. The suit was like a, yeah, some kind of spandexy, you know, I know that's why every day at lunch I would go run 8 to 10 miles a day because those suits were unforgiving. And I've always had a, you know, problem trying to stay thin. So every day at lunch, I would go run and I would do it. I had 1 hour and I would get it in, you know, and you have to shower, get back in, make up. But then the circuitry that was on it, that was neoprene, like a wetsuit material. So it was so hot. And then you would strap the armor. That was all Velcroed all around. And your circulation after, you know, 12, 13 hours, you would just, you know, and believe me, I had it easy compared to Sven or Peter. I mean, those guys, Sven couldn't even sit down. I mean, they had to build him like a leaning board. He would just lean against the board so he could get some relief. And, you know, I would, you know, I would lose 10 pounds a day, you know, just from water. Just, and you would never go to the bathroom because you were just sweating like crazy. But when you did have to go, oh my God, you had to get somebody to come with you to get out of that thing because it took forever. So those days where I thought, oh, I'm in my fatigues on this scene. Oh, that's great. You know, because the power suits were, they were tough. They were tough.
You know, the leaning thing, I think Anthony Daniels, C-3PO, has talked about that same thing of them, you know, having to lean him and bring in a hand trolley to get him places. And but you mentioned 12 to 13 hour days. So, I mean, I know it was a long time ago, but in terms of your production schedule, like one episode takes how long to film? And then you're showing up how early in the morning for 13 hours?
We usually would start, gosh, it's hard to remember. I would say we started around 8,
okay,
something like that. So it wasn't really terrible. Sometimes, though, excuse me, if we were maybe a low, we didn't do a lot of location stuff. Most of it was right there, you know, at the factory, as we called it. And sometimes you would film scenes from 2 or 3 episodes in the same day. You know, okay, well, let's get this. While we got this set up, let's, you know, and then go change. And now switch the script. Now it's what's going on, you know. So, yeah, it was, you know, but that's your job, you know, as an actor. That's your job is to, you know, I think Cary Grant always, one of my favorite quotes was, you know, they don't pay me to act. They pay me to wait. And that's the whole point. You sit around, poor David Hemblin, this guy, you know, he had to put that all that stuff on his face, you know, the big prosthetic thing on his face. And then he would just sit and, you know, we'd get behind and he would just sit there all day and never get on the set. You know, that happened. And it happened to me a couple of times, too, where you just came in and you just sat all day and never, because you'd get behind or something didn't work or, you know, they were having trouble with the camera, you know, whatever it is. But sometimes it was, you know, every scene had this smoke. It was all smoky, you know. And at the end of the day, you would just like blow your nose and it'd just be black. You start thinking to yourself, you know, down the line, am I going to, you know, what am I breathing in here? I don't even know, you know. So that kind of stuff, it was a tough shoot. But the saving grace, for me at least, was the cast and the crew. They were exceptionally great. And we as a cast, I can tell you, we got along absolutely great. I mean, I don't remember us ever having a conflict of any kind. We just had fun. We were having a good time, and we knew that some days it was going to just be hell, and that was okay. You know, we'd hang out and have a good time. And Sven always had a poker game going in his dressing room. That was always fun. So
this was before cell phones and social media. So if you're waiting all day, my first thought as a book collector is like, what the hell were you reading? But it also sounds like maybe you were playing poker sometimes.
Sven always had a poker game going on. I did a lot of reading. I read, I don't know how many books I read, but I read a ton of books because, you know, and remember, there's also no air conditioning. Oof. No, there was no air conditioning whatsoever. So, and, you know, I didn't realize, I kept thinking, oh, we're going to be in Canada. So, yeah, it'll be great. Oh, my God. You know, some days it was 95 to 100 degrees and you're in suits. And so, you know, there was times where, you know, you'd get a little, you'd have to say stop because I'm getting a little lightheaded. I'm starting to, you know, okay, you had to down some water and sit down and they put a fan on you or a cold rag or something. Because there was times where you just almost felt like you're going to pass out.
Holy shit.
You know, again, yeah, that was tough, but it was fun. It was still fun.
What's your genre of book? What kind of stuff do you like to read?
I like biographies a lot. I'm a big fan of just learning about, I just read Martin Short's a biography, FASTA, because I love Martin Short. I think he's a genius. I'm very big into the Greatest Generation, the World War II, reading about those men and women who we just don't produce people like that anymore. I'm fascinated with that. I'm not a sci-fi guy, to say the truth, but I do love sci-fi movies and things like that. I'll watch anything because I think maybe because I did Captain. There's a lot of times I'll watch and go, oh, I bet that was hot. I bet that was hard to do. You know, you know, you kind of have an understanding of, oh, I bet that scene sucked. I bet they hated that, you know? So it was fun.
You have that sympathetic gene while sitting in the seats.
Yes, exactly right. But, you know, it was great. It was a fun time. I made lifelong friends. I loved living up in Toronto. It was a great city. But then it all came to an end. You know, we had the second season ready to go. Everything was set. And, you know, they pulled the money on us. And it was a really expensive show. Remember, this is 1987. I think it was like $1 million per. So that was really high back then.
And it's a children's show. So
not really. You know, see, I mean, it's really not.
The themes are really adult.
I agree. And that's how we did it.
When you're reading the scripts and when you're on stage acting and everything, were you cognizant of, like, I'm doing these dystopic and very adult themes for children?
Absolutely. There was no time, I don't think any of us thought, well, we're doing a kid's show. We never said that because in my heart, I wasn't doing a kid's show. I was doing a very serious show about very real people. And I mean, how many kids show kill off one of the main characters at the end of the first season, for God's sakes?
And the writer had to publicly talk about how that happened and why. And yeah, it means a lot. That's one of the things that in my interests are quite expansive, but G.I. Joe is one of my main loves. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that in that community we talk about regularly is how Larry Hama, who was writing the comics, he was writing the comics for 8 to 12-year-olds, and so he wrote it at a 17 to 18-year-old level. And Captain Power feels the same.
Yeah.
It feels like a show probably targeted to 12, 10. I mean, there's action figures involved, so 8 to 10, 8 to 12.
I guess.
But you guys were writing and acting above that level, which is why it felt, with the type of shows that came before you guys and after you guys, very campy.
Right.
You know, it feels like you're part of that tradition because of the age range you were hitting, but your storylines were very thick. I mean, I had to go back and watch recently because I hadn't seen them in years, just because there's so much to watch and everything else. But it was something that I grew up on and I enjoyed and I loved. And so to come back to it and to meet you gave me that opportunity to see it from fresh eyes, from adult eyes. And even as a child, I didn't see what you guys were doing in the way that you would have. And even as a young man, it would have been, oh, I love this as a kid. But now in my late 40s, I'm like, whew, this is for kids, huh?
Exactly. And that's how kind of when I first watched it, I remember they gave me video cassettes of every show. So 20, whatever video cassettes, you know, with the blank for the commercials. I mean, right off the first run, I still have them actually.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's pretty cool actually. But I remember watching it for the first time and going, wow, I mean, this is nothing like I thought it was going to be. You know, I thought in the beginning, I thought I went to Canada to do a kid's show. But it didn't take long to realize that, first of all, we had some really good actors up there. And then all of a sudden, you're in the middle of a scene and you realize, wow, I mean, that was, you know, cut. And you're like, you look at kind of each other and go, damn, that was good, man. You know, and kind of high five each other. And like, man, that was a freaking good scene right there. And they're driving, yeah, man, that's good. And all of a sudden you realize, no, we're talking about a family here. We're talking about humanity and hope. And things like that, and never giving up, and life is so precious, which is why I didn't understand these crazy ladies who said we were teaching kids to kill and all that because of the toys. You know, there was that's what helped end the show, was there's a couple women who said we were, you know, hurting children. And I kept saying, but all we teach is how precious life is. I said, do you understand? Those are robots we're shooting. We're not shooting humans.
Right.
And every episode we talk about how valuable life was and how hope and keep fighting and don't give up. And these were all good things for children to learn, I thought. But that was it, man. They got some press and boom, that the toys didn't sell. And that was the end of it. And that's Hollywood. I mean, and that's just how it is.
And that period of time was rife with the Christian groups. They were fighting Dungeons and Dragons. They were fighting He-Man and half the other cartoons. I did not know until like we were going to meet, because I hadn't researched that, but I didn't know that that was part of your guys' story, was that they were after you too. You guys were right there with rock and roll and Dungeons and Dragons of being evil and bad for kids.
Yeah. And we tried to do some kind of press for the show, and all they wanted to talk about was the toy. And after a while, I just told them, I said, I have nothing to do with the toy.
Yeah.
I said, you have to understand something. The toy never comes up in my day for months. We didn't care. We didn't care about toys. You know, we cared about if they were going to use our images on certain things and get paid for it, because that's business.
Sure.
But as far as what I wouldn't, first of all, I tried to tell them, first of all, you know, I wouldn't do a show that I thought was harming children, for God's sakes. What do you think I am? You know, you're kind of insulting me here, you know. They didn't see it that way. And well, we're not blaming you. And I'm like, well, yeah, actually, you kind of are blaming me, you know, because I'm the guy who's the names on the show, you know. So it really irritated me a lot. And I always just felt it never got its fair shake. It just as the show. Just I mean, if there was no toy, I guarantee you we would have done a second season. I'd put money on it.
Sure. Well, if there was no toy, you would have had a different time slot, probably aimed at an older audience, because it was older themes.
And remember too, Jason, there was no cable TV. There was nothing, you know, we had three or four channels. You know, you either worked for NBC, ABC, CBS, PBS, Fox. That was it. There was no TBS and TNT and Netflix and all this stuff. I talk to these young actors now and they tell me how tough it is. I go, get out of here. I said, dude, you've got more jobs at your fingertips than I had in my whole career. You know, when I would go in, you'd see the same guys every audition. You got to know them, you know, because we were all up for the same. There was only a limited amount of things to do. So it was really hard to make a living, you know, to consistently. And, you know, and that's why if you got a series, man, oh, that was the, you know, that was the gem. You know, you didn't have to, you know, drive a limousine on the weekend or work as a waiter anymore or something like that. You know, and I was lucky. I really never had to do that. I had a short period of time there back in the mid-80s, right before, maybe 4 years or so before Power. I had to take a weekend job because just to make ends meet. I mean, I was there, but I was lucky that I always, you know, number one, I had tremendous agents who got me in the door. And I always said, hey, your job is to get me in the door. And once, you know, then it's up to me. It's up to me to get the job. Luckily, I got my fair share. I lost some too, but it was a wonderful career and a fun life. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it to the time where I decided I wanted to try to do something different, you know, and I didn't want to just, I don't know why. Now I look back and think, that's kind of stupid, actually. But I don't know. At the time, it seemed like the right thing to do.
After spending years in hot suits with fans and everything else, it is a tough gig, right? It looks easy to us because we're watching the finished product.
Oh, yeah.
But we're not seeing the 13-hour days.
You kind of get tired of being judged. You know, can you imagine if you're judged completely on... I was completely on my success, who I was, who I am as a person was completely judged on my resume.
Yeah.
And I just got tired of that, I guess. I just kind of thought, well, you know, I have other interests than acting. I love acting. I love it more than probably anything in the world. Still do, actually. But that doesn't mean I didn't like figuring out how to amortize a 30-year mortgage and make the payments work, you know, and at the present rate of return. And, you know, I found that interesting, too. And I know that over the years, I've been lucky enough to hear from fans about how, wow, you know, when you hear from a fan that says, you know, when I was a kid, my house was really tough and my parents were, you know, arguing and there was a lot of fighting. And I could, when I watched that show and I watched you on that show and it made me feel better and it got me through these certain, you know, as an actor, you're not thinking about stuff like that. And when you hear it, you realize, my goodness, you know, it's way more than just what I thought at that time. You know, it's a lasting impression on, you know, I got an email recently from a guy who's a brigadier general. And he said, oh, man, you're part of the reason I went into the military. You know, you're like, wow. I mean, I was just a dumb actor. I don't know, you know. But then I figured, wow, I was helping. I really was helping people way more than I thought it was. Well, it's kind of mortgage was kind of the same thing. You know, when you sit across the table from some nice young couple and they've been told two or three times, sorry, you can't get a house. And I think, nah, well, I know how. I know how to get you one. Here's what we'll do. And you get them and they get that house and they get that loan. You know, that's pretty close to feeling the same feeling you had when you did a great scene or you got the applause at the end of a show or something. It's real close because you're actually making a difference in somebody's life. And I think for me, that's what joy, that's what happiness was knowing that I've done something to help other people. And that's why I'm trying to do what we're sitting here talking about now. And for 20 years, I've done no appearances. I've done nothing. But in talking to these fans now recently, I want to give them something back. I want to go meet them. I want to shake their hand. I want to want them to not just sign a picture and get out of the line. You know, no. So, who are you? And what's your name? Where'd you go to school? Where'd you grow up? And what do you like? What's your interest? And do you have a family? Why not? I mean, that you know, you meet somebody and there's nothing worse than you meet them and go, oh man, he was such a jerk. Because I've had that happen to me as an actor. You know, where I was so excited about working with some really big name and they were just a total jerk, you know.
And all of us that were fans of Captain Power as a kid, whether it be very young or in our teens, somewhere in the middle, those of us that are still in this, whether collecting toys or VHSs or whatever we collect, it becomes a community. And so most of us, that's all we're looking for. So when somebody like yourself walks in, we're at a point where we've lived a full life. We're not that first fan of, you know, what powers your communicator, but we're more of like, hey, you know, we've built this community around a thing that you had a part of. You want to join the community? We're here.
That's exactly it. You're exactly right.
And to come in and want to be a part of that community is something special because not everyone can, not everyone wants to. So it's been 20 years, but now you're back and you're going, I'm available. I like the community. I like what I did. And coming out on the road and hanging out with us and meeting everybody, having a drink or breaking bread and telling stories, that's really all we're...
Yeah.
That's the whole reason why we travel around anyway. It's why we do this. It's why we spend our, you know, our hard-earned dime on it.
And I can tell you, there's nothing I enjoy more. I enjoy, you know, if anybody wants to sit and listen to my, you know, old stories, well, gosh, God bless you. Because believe me, my girlfriend and all, they don't want to hear that shit anymore. They're tired of hearing about it. You know, so it's nice to be able to talk to somebody or someone to ask about, you know, well, you worked with so-and-so. What was that like? Or, you know, or how was the suit? Or when you were doing Davy Crockett, what was it like working with a 10.5-foot Kodiak grizzly, you know? And you tell them, you know, there's great stories involved in all that because maybe after a while, you're, you know, our Timberwolves and all that. I worked with, like I told you in the beginning, I worked with every animal in Hollywood. I was the animal king. It's amazing, too, when you stand in front, you know, you're 5 feet in front of a 11-foot, 1,800-pound Kodiak grizzly bear on his rear legs, and you're supposed to film. It's you know, not that many people get to do that in their regular day. So it's pretty cool.
And at 6'5", you know, you're not used to being the small guy in the room.
No. And I lost a lot of work because I was 6'5", too. I mean, I lost all kinds of jobs. I was just too tall. You know, and I tell you a great story. I was doing Davy Crockett. Our director of photography was a guy named Isidore Mankowski, who's an Academy Award winning, an amazing man. And he, one day we're out in the, I don't know, wherever the hell we were, out in the middle of nowhere. He looked at me and he said, well, you know, you've made it now. And I said, oh, why? Because I'm playing David Crockett. He said, no. He said, because I guarantee you, he says, tell me if I'm wrong. Every other job you've ever had up until now, they would dig a hole and you would have to stand in it because you were too tall to get with the leading. And I said, yes, sir. I stood in many a hole.
Wow. Okay.
And so he said, now he goes, everybody else has got to stand on boxes. And I said, he goes, that's when you know you've made it. And I never forgot that. I thought it was so funny. I mean, it's so true. Right on the money.
That's a fantastic demarcation.
Yes. Yeah. That's how you know you've made. And I kind of thought, well, you mean how I made it because I'm doing the lead in the series. He couldn't have cared less about that. He said, no, you don't stand in holes anymore. And I thought, oh, you know, he's got a good point there because I stood in many a hole. And one of the guys on Fall Guy, I think he was the DOP. And this guy had worked on like Shane. You know, old, you know, movies like I love. And he brought in pictures, actually, and showed because Van Heflin was taller than what's his name? I can't think of his name now. The lead. He was shorter. And they had a scene where they walked across this corral. And he was the shot. They just dug a trench because Van Heflin had a walk. And he said, and I told him that story. He says, Izzy knows exactly what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Those are the things, again, you know, that those stay in my head because those were the moments where you were just having so much fun. You know, you couldn't believe they were paying me to do this. I would have done it for nothing. You know, I would have done it for free.
That's part of the magic question mark of Hollywood that we don't ever see of, oh, you're 5 inches taller, so you got to stand in a hole.
And it's sad because those are great moments. Those are.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and you'd be, you know, I'll never forget. I worked with a guy who was a special effects guy at Warner Brothers. We played on a baseball team together. He worked on Poltergeist.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, oh, man. I said, he said, yeah, I was the guy who made the chair slide across. And I was the guy when all the maggots and stuff came up out of the steak. Remember? I said, you're kidding me. That was you. He goes, yeah, that was me. I go, I'm thinking, okay, well, how did you do it? And he said, well, I got in the cabinet under there and I got a caulking gun full of crap and I just stuck it up the hole and I just shot it. that's it. Because I thought it was going to be some, you know, super special. You know, nah, I just stuck a thing up there and I just shot it through there. And then I said, what about the chair? Nah, I just got some wire just dragged across the ground. You know? And you're thinking, oh, I don't want it. That ruins the magic. I don't want to know that, you know?
He's blasé about something that you're freaking out over. That's great.
Yeah. You know, I was so, oh, my, how did you do that? I just got to get under the cabinet and I just shot it up there. And that's how most of those guys were. They were all special effects guys. And most of the time, that's exactly what it was, something, yeah, just basic, you know. But again, these were those guys I used to love hanging with. All those, the crew guys were always my favorite because, you know, they're just working Joes, you know, they're just regular working guys. And I loved hanging with them. They reminded me of being at home and my friends and family. So.
Do you still have a continuing relationship with people that you acted with or any of these crews from either Davy Crockett or from Power?
I'm sorry to say, not really. And it's just because life is like that. Unfortunately, you know, again, I've never been closer cast than I was with the Captain Power people, but we don't talk that much. And that's just the nature of the business. It's not anything personal or I don't want to talk to you or not at all. It's just your life's going, you're together in this battle and then you go home, you know, and then you got a new battle and and now it's a new crew and a new thing. But I still call them all my friends. I mean, if I see them, of course, I miss them and I miss our times, but we stay in touch on Facebook and stuff and as much as possible. But no, I mean, like, especially like the Captain Power crew guys, those camera guys, they got me through many a day because they would just crack me up or just take your mind off whatever it was. I'll tell you a great story about that. I was doing Wizards and Warriors, right, this show, and Bill Bixby was the director. And I was very nervous about working with Bill Bixby. As a kid, I watched him all the time on My Favorite Martian and The Hulk, right? I had this huge entrance, this humongous entrance. It must have been 65, 70 feet that I had to walk in. And remember, I'm all in a cape and this all, you know, mid-century. And I had this huge hat with a big feather in it. And I had to walk in I walked in, and I did this big elaborate bow in front of Julia Duffy. And the line was, "Your hair is the essence of radiance and all consuming loveliness." Well, Jason, I couldn't remember that line to save my life. I came in, I blew it. All right, let's set it up again. Now, remember, this is a huge shot, tracking all kind. All right, the lighting. I bet you I blew it, I don't know, 5 times, 6 times.
Enough that you remember it today.
I'll never forget it again. And here's why. So I'm thinking, remember, this is my first, I've just got to Hollywood. It's my first shot. And of course, my head is, that's it. I'm going to get fired. They're going to fire me because they think I'm a stupid actor and I don't know what I'm doing. And I'm an idiot. And oh, I'm the worst actor in the world. You know, and it builds and it builds and it builds. And Bixby said, come here. And I thought, oh, here it comes. And he looked at me and he said, Jane, who was the script, what's the line again? And she read the line. And he looked at me and said, I'm glad that's not mine. All right, let's try it again. And I cracked up and I got it just like that. He knew exactly what was going on in my head. He knew exactly what I was thinking and he knew exactly how to pull me out of it. And I'll never forget that. And I got to see him before he passed away when I was filming Davy Crockett up in Vancouver. He was in the hotel. I saw him and I got to sit and have a drink and talk to him. And I told him, honey, he didn't remember it. But I thought, oh, I said, Bill, you'll never know that. I think you saved my career right then and there because I was ready to just fall off the edge. Those are the things you remember, you know, the moments where I thought, oh, my God, you know, how stupid can I be here? You know, but it happens. You know, there's certain more. And especially on Captain Power. I mean, sometimes you'd get a speech. And remember, sometimes they'd hand you the speech. Now, you'd been up rehearsing all night some other thing and they changed it. And, you know, you're getting ready to, oh, here's the new. And it's this long, you know, and you're like, whoa, wait a minute. And it was all technical. And I'm thinking, I don't know what the hell I'm saying here. You know, that was hard. And you had to make sense of it. And you had to, you know, and luckily your training, especially as an actor, it doesn't look as one big problem. You break it into, and where's, okay, and the breath is here. And there, and then here, pause, and that helps you actually remember the lines. You know, the worst thing you can do is try to memorize words. You don't want to memorize words. You want to memorize, what am I trying to tell you? What's the object? Why am I in this room? Why don't I walk out and leave? Why am I here? And these are all basic acting things, but they really do work. And I tell you what, I think everybody should be required to take an acting class in their life because you're going to learn a lot about yourself and about relaying and talking with people. You know, the great actors don't make their money when they're speaking. They make it when they're listening, because that's where it's about. It's all about when you're listening and what you're, that's a mark of a great actor in my book. And so at least that's what I was taught and I believe it.
I love hearing about that level of confidence in someone who can look at a young actor, because I mean, half the job isn't just making sure the shot is right, but managing everyone there. And he could manage you in a heartbeat.
Oh, you know, there's all kinds of egos and there's all kinds of people who think, you know, my next job. And it's a business, you know, it's a super business, but it's a business where sometimes you get to make really, really nice art. And when you get to do that, you know, again, that's when you think, yeah, keep the check, keep it. You know, that's like when I did Cheers. I mean, the guy called me up and said, Randy, who was the I knew him. He says, I'm embarrassed to call you. He says, but I got this little part on Cheers. It's like 4 lines, but the guy, it's a setup for a joke and the guy's not doing it. It's not me. Can you come in and do it? And I was like, are you kidding me? He said, I know. And I go, no, I'm happy. Sure. I went down at like 8 o'clock at night or so. And I went into some room with that and he goes, yes, that's exactly it. You know, I got what was going on, you know, it was a setup joke for Diane. You had to set her up. And so, I can only pay you whatever it was, you know? And I was like, man, I do prop do it for nothing. I don't care. You know, I get those because I love that show. I love Cheers. So I got to, you know, walk around the set and look at stuff on the walls and got to talk with John Ratzenberger and Kelsey, you know, just talk to them all and it was fun. I mean, it was that. That's when it was. You know, I can tell you, I can remember so many times just driving home, being on the 101 freeway, just thinking, how the hell did I get here? You know, how the hell did I go from Charlie Brown, you know, and a lighting guy, to sitting here and filming on Cheers? You know, it was a lot of fun, man. I was lucky, and I just had a ball. I had a great time.
I'm floored by these kind of things. Like, that's because, I mean, you know, we all watched Cheers. We all watched. You were on a ton of things. And obviously, you know, Davy Crockett and Captain Power were the two big ones. All of us watched both of those, right? Like, we're here talking about Captain Power, but there's not a one of us that had access to the Disney Channel either at home, if you were lucky, or at your friend's house or grandma's house that didn't watch Davy Crockett.
Bill Blinn was the writer, and he wrote like Brian's Song, and he wrote Purple Rain, the movie. You know, Bill was a great writer, and I really loved working with him because he'd be on set sometimes, and you know, he'd kind of talk it over a little bit, and hey, maybe what, try this or try, and that's when it's really exciting, and especially if you, the director like Bill Bixby or David Hemmings, or who directed the pilot, the movie of Davy Crockett that we did, you know, just an amazing insight into, you know, where he'd say, but if you pause there instead of here, try that. And all of a sudden you do it and it's just like a door opens. But oh man, yes, now I see. And that's all it would take. It would just take, you know, him just changing one little thing where you put the emphasis instead of here, it changed the whole scene. That was when you just like were floating off the air a little bit. Your steps were just a little bit with air underneath it the rest of the day. And that was what was I loved. That was what I loved the most.
Do you ever go back and do any theater or walk-in stuff today, or are you completely out of it at this point?
No, I haven't, but you know what? It's never too late, right? I mean, I'm sure they need an old fat white guy somewhere.
They need actors of all ages, all sizes.
Well, I hate to tell you this, but I wish that was true. There's not a whole lot of roles for when you start getting into your senior area, especially women. Women have it worse than us. But there's a lot less roles. But again, that doesn't mean there isn't parts, of course. But again, you know, it's changed so much, Jason. I wouldn't even know what to do now. You know, it's all online. You know, I'm still the guy. I got to go over and pick up the sides. You know, I had to go to get your car and drive over, pick up the sides so you knew what the script was. And, you know, now it's all different. And there, I'd probably just be some stupid dinosaur. But yeah, I mean, if somebody came to me and said, like an example, when they were talking about rebooting and doing Phoenix Rising, and they said, hey, we're thinking about maybe you could be mentor, you know, you could do the, and I said, sure, you know, that would be awesome. I would really love that because number one, I don't have to wear that suit. Number two, I got to imagine I come in and film one or two days and boom, I'm done, you know? So I said, heck yeah, that sounds good to me. But unfortunately that didn't happen.
You show up in fatigues in the comfy chair and...
You know, that's why I always say, boy, you know, the great jobs are anytime you can get into those animation movies. Yeah, man, you put on a pair of sweatpants and a shirt, go in, record a few things, get your check, go home. You don't have to worry about how's my hair? Do I look good? And yeah, God, I look fat and da, 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 da. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff, you know. But again, when you get to this age now, I don't worry about it anyway. It doesn't matter. I don't care. I did my time.
Well, and you've built a hell of a career in the mortgages.
Yeah, I had a good run.
We're about to see you in Augusta, Georgia at Joe Fest. You're going to be hanging out with Destro's Toy Den, signing autographs, meeting people.
Yeah.
My assumption, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but my assumption, you might have a few things to maybe sell, some memorabilia or some unique pieces that people might be interested in.
I do. I'm actually bringing a lot of my own personal collection.
Okay.
And a lot of that will be for sale. You know, Jason, I don't have any kids and I don't have a family. And if it's not that my family wouldn't cherish it, my nieces and nephews, don't get me wrong, but I would like it to go to people who really loved the show. So some of it will be I'm bringing, for example, I've got the watch I wore as Captain Power plus Tank's watch. Both of them. I have those.
Oh, wow.
I've got one of the original gun belts that we wore on the fatigues.
So on screen props.
Original scripts. I've brought my scripts that I actually used to film. The storyboards, everything. I still have all that. Plus, I had Ron Nomura make up 3D print about 6 or 7 of the power badges. They are absolutely perfect, and with magnets, so you can put them on your shirt, you know. I'm going to bring those, and I think I'll sell a few of those for people and sign them. I can sign them on the back if they want. But yeah, I'm looking forward to, you know, pictures, and I know Todd's got some stuff, sign some toys or whatever it is. If that's what people want, fantastic. I'm glad to do it. Hope that if they come and get a signed picture that, you know, we can sit and talk in a little bit while we're doing it and get to meet people. And
it's a good show. It's 3 long days, and this particular show is known for its bar con, meaning once the commerce is closed, we're still up all night in the lobby.
Oh, geez.
You'll have plenty of time to vanish or to stay as engaged as you want to be. It's going to be fun.
Like I told you, I got a lot of stories. I can tell. I haven't told you a lot of them. I'm not doing it on camera.
I'm excited that people are going to come and see you at Joe Fest, that you're going to be with Steve and with Todd, A and I and Joel. It's going to be a good weekend. It's one of my favorite weekends of the year. As you had mentioned, you're also going to be doing Kentuckiana, which is later on in July, and that's in Louisville, Kentucky. And that's a bit of an older crowd and a smaller crowd, but still a vibrant, growing, and very fun show. So between these two, people really have an opportunity to come out and chat. Thank you for what you did way back when we were all 8, 9, 10, 12, 17. If people want to go back and catch up on Captain Power and the Soldiers of the Future, you can find a lot of the episodes on YouTube and on Amazon Prime. So I'm sure there's DVDs out there, but in today's streaming world,
they're discontinued. They're kind of rare, actually. And I'm bringing about, I got about 4 or 5 unopened ones that I'm going to sign and sell people to, so they can have that. Because I'm, you know, you have to understand, I haven't signed much stuff at all because I just haven't done anything. So, you know, it'll be if you're into it and that means something to you, I'll look forward to doing that, you know, and signing it, and we'll all have a good time.
Yeah. So before today, everybody that had your signature needed to get a mortgage.
That's correct. Yeah, to get it's going to cost you at least, well, back when I was doing it, my problem was I put everybody in at about 2.5%, and now it's at 7. So that's it. That business is all gone. And but that's okay. I'm getting older, and I don't need it anymore. So, but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed, like I said, I enjoyed doing the mortgage business, and because again, I got to meet a lot of really nice people, and I got to help them. And as Captain Power and as Davy Crockett and Face Man and all that, I got to do the same thing in just a different way. So I'm looking forward to being at Joe Fest, and I'm looking forward to meeting that. I've never been to Augusta, so I'm looking forward to seeing that a little bit. And I'm sure I can get a round in over there at the Masters. I'm sure they'll let me play, right?
Sure. Why not?
Yeah. I don't think they even let you on the place. I don't think you can get in there. I thought, well, maybe if I drop a little Captain Power, they'll say, get out of here, you know it.
Just knock on the front door. Why not?
I play Captain Power. Take a hike, pal.
Find out find the children of that old grizzly bear and show up.
Bart. Bart, he was a fan. You know that Bart, he made $10,000 a day. He was making more money than I was.
Wow.
Yeah. He made 10 grand a day. And his trainer was a little guy from like El Salvador. And I thought, what does this guy know about Kodiak grizzly bears? Because the director wanted me to, like, you know, I had to do this thing where I did it. I come running up, and he's up on his hind legs, and he's gotten my Georgie. He's gotten my buddy. And I'm supposed to I did a gun stunt where the gun backfired on me. So I did that. And then I'm supposed to stand up, like pull out my knife and kind of look at the knife and look at him and toss it. And then the director says, I want you to just scream at the top of your lungs and take a couple steps at him. And then the bear is going to run off. And I said, I looked at him. I said, have you talked to the trainer about that? He said, oh, no, I'm sure it'll be OK. And I said, let's go talk to him. So we went over and I said, hi. I said, I'm Tim. Hi, nice to meet you. I said, listen, the director wants me to like scream at the top of my lungs and then kind of make a bold move towards him. I said, is that permissible? Is that good? Can we do that? And he goes, yeah, I think so. And I said, well, we said, whoa. I said, because I think so is not going to make it with me, because that is a big ass bear. I mean, this thing is huge. And I was like, no, he'll be. And I have to tell you, that bear, that what a pro. He hit his marks. He did his stuff. He said, go back in his box, sit down. They bring him back out. Boom, bam. He was with almost any like leading lady I ever had. Absolutely the greatest. I loved working with him. Bart the Bear. He was very famous. Bart, look him up. His son, I think, now just retired. It's a whole family thing. They got, you know, they're like the family of actors, the Redgraves, you know, or somebody like that in Bear World.
That's incredible.
You have to understand, for 2 days, they kept saying to us, listen, the bear's coming in on Thursday, and they sent out a thing, no loud noises, no coffee, don't bring any food down the set. If you're a woman and you're having your time of month, let us know.
Wow.
And I'm looking at this thing, and I look at the script, and I'm like, holy crap, I'm in for big trouble here. This could be very dangerous, you know? So we come down to the set, and honestly, there was a crate that you could have put a Volkswagen in. It was huge. And they opened that thing up, and he walked out. I have some pictures. I should bring them. He was enormous. I mean, his head was 3.5-4 feet wide. Just his head. And this guy tells me, yeah, just, and I said, yeah, I don't know. I make a living with this right here, buddy. I said, so I don't want any bear claws coming at me.
Yeah, no loud noises, no coffee, no menstruation, but hey, scream at it. That's
yeah, go ahead and scream at it. Yeah, and then they said, oh, and there's another one where they brought in timber wolves. And they said, you know, and these timber wolves are looking at you like, I'm going to eat your ass. I mean, they're just not, you know. And I said, oh, and this scene, then you wrestle them, and then, you kill them, you know, you stab them. And I said, I'm not getting in with that thing. Are you? They said, oh, no. He's got a bad tooth. So we're going to knock him out. And then we're going to lay him. You lay down. We're going to lay him on top of you. Because the stunt guy will do the thing. And then we'll just have him. And then you just roll him off and get up. And so that's what they did. They and then right away, the guy came in and they took his tooth out while we were sitting there setting up for the next scene.
So you were part of the dentistry.
I told him, yeah. I said, he must have good insurance because but he didn't even have to go to the office. They came out right here and did it, you know. Yeah, those are the things that happen when you're filming the stuff like a period piece and or animals. Anytime you're working with animals, man, I mean, they're just you don't know what they're going to do. You know, like I could tell you those apes, those orangutans, if they didn't want to work, they didn't work. That's just how it was. Nobody was going to make them work.
It's funny. You said that you've worked with every animal in Hollywood, but it sounds like you've only worked with the ones that could kill a man.
Yeah, well, I never got any cute puppies, I can tell you that much. All right, Tim, you know, run up the mountain, Tim. Run down the mountain. Run up the mountain, you know, Davy Crockett. And then here, another one. What's Davy Crockett wear? Buckskins. Oh, my God, I'd be sweating like a bear. I was dying. It was so hot. And then that coonskin cap, that thing doesn't let any air in, you know. And then they're telling me, your hair blends in too much. We're going to put highlights in your hair. And I was like, oh, man, I don't want to put highlights in my. We did it. It's just part of the business. You just got used to it. And that was it. If you just concentrated on the scripts and concentrated on doing your job, there's a big difference I found in Captain Power and Davy Crockett. The main difference is when you're the guy, when you're the man, the name, there's no days off. There's no scenes off. There's no time like, I'm going to go in my trailer for a couple hours and take a nap. Uh-uh. You know, yeah, okay, lunch. Oh, by the way, you know, Entertainment Tonight's going to be here during lunch, so we want you to do an interview. Oh, on Saturday, we need you to fly down and do this morning show, da-da-da. You're just, it's constant. And I ended up in the hospital after Crockett. I got bit by something up in the woods, and I had this rash all, I was getting married. I was going to get married. I had this rash all over my body. And they sent me to some doctors in Beverly Hills, you know, and they say, okay, take off your clothes. I take off all my clothes and they walk in like three of them. Then they go, turn around. And then here's what they said. Well, I don't know what you got, but you sure got it. I was like, well, what the hell is that? So I had to take like, you know, baths with oatmeal and everything. Oh, my God. I don't know. They said it looks like you're some kind of spider or something got you. And then also he said, I think you're also just completely exhausted. I was really exhausted. I mean, that was a tough shoot. And I had to take some time off. I mean, I was going to end up in the hospital. That's it. I mean, that's what happens, you know, and that's part of the deal. So when people say, oh, you know, these actors, they got it so easy. Yeah, some days you have it easy. Some days you don't have it so easy. And it's, I'll end with this because I know I'm going on. But, you know, that's why when I went to do when I was going to do mortgages, you know what the best thing sounded to me? You go to work Monday through Friday. You're off at a certain time. You got weekends. Sometimes you had weekends. You got to work weekends. But here's the other one. You got a vacation. You got 2 weeks paid vacation. I never had that in my life. I said, wait a minute. You get paid to go on vacation? I didn't even know that existed. I never had that. I just thought that sounded so good. Just get up, go to work, do your job, come home, have a life. I did, and a steady paycheck. I never had that. From the time I was 16 years old, I never had it. So that, and of course, then I learned mortgage is actually kind of like acting. You don't do loans, you don't get paid. You know, so it really was just the same thing.
This has been a lot of fun. And I appreciate you coming on.
Oh, thank you. I've enjoyed it too, Jason. Thank you.
And not just that I appreciate you coming on, but I appreciate you coming out and being a part of the Joe community and the 80s cartoons and toys and this community of all of us that grew up on.
I'm really looking forward to it because I figure, you know, I don't know much about it. I'm looking forward to, like, you know, walking around and seeing things and talking to people. And I like comic books, you know, so I don't know if there'll be comic books there. But I always look for, I was a big fan. You probably don't remember, but there was in the 60s, when I was a kid, the big comic book for me was called Metal Men.
I mean, I'm aware of it. It's been a very long time.
I still have mine from the 60s.
That was DC, right?
Yep, it was a DC comic, and that was my favorite. Along with, of course, Batman was my big one. But I'm talking about like 63 now. 64.
Well, you grew up at a great time for comic books because you're coming out of Golden Keys and all the romance and the horror comic books. You're walking into all the superhero stuff. Yeah, what a great time for. To be a comic book guy.
Oh, it was great. And I mean, the artwork was so good. And I, as a kid, even I just loved it. And I used to try to, you know, draw. I wanted to learn to draw like that and stuff, but I just didn't have the talent. But I would do, you know, all kinds of stuff like that as a kid, draw things. And I got really, when I was a kid, I used to like to draw baseball uniforms. And I try to make sure I got everything right. And to this day, I'm a nut about baseball uniforms and old baseball uniforms and new and you know, I just enjoy it. It's silly, but
do you still play at all?
I don't anymore. I did for years. I used to play three days a week. I used to play baseball and fast pitch softball. I got in like three leagues, and that's why people were like, "Oh, you have to go." And I'm like, "Ah, I got a game." You know, well, no, you got to do this. I got a game. So of course, you know, that didn't go with my agents. What do you mean you're not doing it? You know, it's like, I got a game, man. It's a big game. You know, so cause I loved playing and I love baseball. I'm a huge St. Louis Cardinals fan.
So. Okay. So Cardinals are your team.
I grew up, my mom and dad worked for them. So I was really big. I grew up in the stadium. Like I was there every day.
That's amazing. So I used to work with a guy up until a couple of years after he retired. He was a part of a baseball league that was a turn-of-the-century baseball league.
Oh, cool. I've seen those.
Old uniforms, the old gloves, the old balls.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so I don't know if you have anything like that out by you, but that I thought was very interesting.
I just got into the, you know, like I've lived in the San Fernando Valley, and they used to have what they called the Valley League. And that was top-notch, you know, a lot of very big baseball players come from that area. So that was a tough league. I mean, and I really enjoyed it. I just loved playing ball. I was, you know, okay. I wasn't great by any means, but I didn't care because, you know, again, as we're talking here, the best part was after the game, you went out and, you had a few drinks, you had something to eat and, you know, give each other crap and have a great time. That was, it's about, you know, it was just hanging out with the guys and, you know, it was innocent, fun,
you know. You know, you've been in California for and now the large majority of your life, but you did not adopt a California team.
Well, I am a bit of an Angels fan.
But they're not the Cardinals.
But they're not. You know, see, if you grow up in St. Louis, you're kind of, that's kind of issued at birth. You know, the Cardinals are, they are everything. And I loved the Cardinals as a kid. And like I said, my mom and dad were in the ticket business. They were, my dad was in charge and mom and dad were in charge. In fact, my mom was in charge when the football Cardinals, before they went to Arizona, she was in charge of their tickets. And then my dad went and he was in charge of the Blues tickets. So I didn't miss a Blues Cardinals game for, I mean, when I was 13 years old, my birthday present was a 50-yard line ticket of my own for the Cardinals football team. You know, that was my, I had a 50-yard line seat and I'd sit there with all these people. They'd be like, who the hell is this kid? You know, I was, you know, 10, 11, 12. So I don't know how old I was. But, you know, I got to hang out with the players and talk to them. And, you know, I remember one time Bart Starr, that was a Monday night game. Bart Starr, the Packers came in. And they kicked the Cardinals' ass. They just kicked him. And I was standing afterwards, waiting for my mom and dad. And I remember Bart Starr came out. And I thought, because I loved Bart Starr, I thought he was the greatest. And so he looked at me and he said, how you doing, son? And I was like, oh, okay. And he goes, did you have a good time tonight? And I said, no, sir. And he said, and he looked at me, no. And I said, no. I said, you guys beat us up pretty bad. And he laughed. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. He says, I'm aching like crazy right now, if that makes you feel any better. And I said, yes, sir, it does make me feel better. And he kind of gave me a pat on the head and said, yeah, all right, take care. So, you know, I got to do fun stuff.
That's incredible.
I've been lucky. I've been very lucky.
I don't even know how to respond to that. That's actually really a great place to cut it, by the way.
it's probably good. I'm sure you got enough to cut out of here. Thank God.
I'm a collector of things, right? I have a lot of hobbies and I collect shit. But I struggle being passive. So I have to do something. I have to be. So this is a way for me to do this, right? Like I get to record with friends. I get to record with authors and toy makers. You know, I've talked to, you know, writers, yourself. And something that struck me throughout most of our conversation is how you continue to bring it back to service. And being of service, whether as an actor or mortgages and everything. And that was the mission statement when Joel and I were designing this show. And he's not here because he's in construction. So he's not available probably until like 9 o'clock tonight. But the point of the show was we didn't care if we were the best show, the biggest show, had the most people listening because we're not doing the video. As long as we're of service.
That's right. And that's what it's all about.
It has to be about.
I mean, it really is. And let me tell you, as a 69-year-old man, I'm telling you, that's what it's all about. It takes a long time, I think, for some people to understand that.
Oh, it does, absolutely. And we can see that in our world today. But for me, it's if I'm going to spend the energy and the money and the time,
right,
it can't just be a gathering and placing of an item and walking away. There has to be more. And for me, that more is this, where I can just highlight someone that I enjoy, someone I respect, someone I like.
I can tell you that in talking with Stephen and Todd, I wanted to make it real clear. I want to be able to sit and talk to people. And I want to, if I'm going to ask somebody to pay for my signature on a picture, I owe them a hell of a lot more than a signature on a picture.
Let's end it here. Thanks again for spending time with us discussing toys and other geeky things. Our logo was made by Rhino. The music we use was created by Self Help. You can find Joel on Instagram at Order of Battle Pod. Jason is on Twitter at Order of Battle PD. Our email is orderofbattlepod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you, and thank you for your likes, comments, outreaches, and just being here with us.
You know, it's funny, too, because I have a cousin who I'm not real close to, and her daughter, oh, I have never met her. I haven't seen her, you know, and I got a letter from her introducing herself, and she goes, you're my cousin, and I didn't know you, and I just saw that you were on TV and all that. And she said, you worked with Johnny Cash. And I was like, yes, I did. I did work with Johnny. And do you? And I, so I had a picture of me and Johnny Cash and I signed it and sent it to her. And, you know, she just thought that was the greatest thing in the whole world. And what was Johnny Cash? And I was like, oh, Johnny Cash was a really cool guy. You know, and nothing, he's everything you would hope he would be. You know, the best thing Johnny Cash said to me when I got to meet him was, Tim, but this is back in 87, now 88. He had a bus. My God in heaven, you should, you know, back then, I had never seen a bus like that. It has all leather couches and, you know, a kitchen and a nice marble bathroom. I said, this, he goes, yeah, this is how me and June travel around. And I was like, buddy, you got the right idea. I got to sit and talk to him about Sun Records and Elvis, and you can't pay me enough for stuff like that. I mean, keep the check. Keep it. I don't care.
This has been The Order of Battle.